Welcome to Journeys in Podcasting. This is the session on mindfulness. We will be in-house studying with Natalia Leon and her students practicing meditation in the mornings. And then we'll talk to our high school psychologist, Felipe Merizalde, who practices meditation with students and faculty and is in charge of student emotional well-being. Then we'll have a discussion with Father Adolfo Vera, Charlotte Samper, and Sonia Bonilla of Colegio Nueva Granada. That one will be in Spanish. And then finally we'll reach out and video conference with Tim Burns, who runs Educare, an education and mindfulness consulting company. So let's now enter Natalia Leon's classroom.
I guess meditation began a while ago, a couple years back. I was teaching second grade, and for some reason I felt that my students needed some time to quiet down and be able to be transported into another place. So I began doing meditation where my students were able to lie down, and I would narrate through the meditation, and I would take them out of our four-walled space. And I would like for them to find a comfort zone inside this little moment or this little time that we had together to meditate. I would not do it very regularly, but the students loved it. Then I did it with my sixth grade class, and I would do it more regularly than I did with my second grade classroom. And they loved it, all of them. I did it with three different classes teaching language arts, and they all loved being able to sit down, relax, be quiet, even if just for 10 or 15 minutes. So then yoga came into my life a couple years later, and I started reading about Zen and Buddhism. And now I practice sitting meditation with my kids every day. I ran into Tim Burns on the way, and also seeing how this impacts the brain made it clear that I needed to do this not four times a week or three times a week, but every single day. It needed to be the way that we began our journey of learning every single day. So basically what we do is we take 10 to 15 minutes of every day. We do a small meeting in the morning, and then we begin our meditation. We practice sitting meditation for 10 minutes. So I guide them through it. We breathe. We focus on music or sounds that come from nature. And I guide them through the meditation and setting an intention for the day in which I want them to work on what I believe they need to put more the most effort on. Right now we're working, for example, on listening with our whole bodies, not just pretending to listen, but actually being fully aware and present, making eye contact, be caring about the other person. And it's been quite a journey, because at the beginning of the year, of the school year, my kids were not able to sit through silently, just like through a 10-minute meditation. It was too long. So we began with a 1-minute meditation and started pumping up from there. And now we can sit silently for 15 minutes. Some of the boys struggle more than the girls do, which is interesting to see. But also my strongest meditators are boys. So it's quite a dichotomy right there that you can see, and how this affects their brain and how it affects their personality, and how we walk into the classroom and into learning and into math, which is our first subject of the day.
Have you seen any cognitive change, academic behaviors in your kids? And I'm thinking of a couple of things. And one is, I think every teacher of early childhood has noticed that when story time comes, everybody calms down. There's something about the narrative itself that puts the mind in a state of, I don't know, kind of being in the present, the what just happened, and predicting what's going to happen kind of in the future. And one meditation method that I have sat through is when, I guess, you lie down and you just close your eyes and someone narrates that you are, becoming a bird, or, yes, you know, you go on these journeys. Have you tried that kind of meditation, and have you seen any benefits to your practices?
I did. I tried it like with my first two grades that I practiced meditation, second grade and sixth grade. I used to do that, and the kids would love doing that. They felt that they had the chance to be transported into a different moment, and that it was not about being in this classroom where everything is very restricted and limited. That when they go there, they can actually, you know, like step out of this whole school environment that sometimes is a little too heavy emotionally for them. However, when it came down to actually seeing improvements in the learning process, I don't think that the practice was was happening enough for them to actually be impacted that way. However, I do see it with my kids in this year, third grade. I see that they are able to focus for a longer period of time. I see that they are able to listen more consciously, like in a more conscious way, rather than just pretending, you know, to listen to the other person. They see that there is something behind this. And I also see a dedication in their practice, when the way they sit, the way that they know that it is hard for them, but still they want to do better and they want to go through the week and know that at the end of the week, it's easier for them to sit through meditation and not just do it because it's what we're intended to do, but because they're going to see some benefits out of it in their, for example, sports or during math time or during read aloud. They know that they're going to see benefits and they're going to feel better as well.
Yeah, a few years ago, for one of our beginning of the year talks, we brought in a speaker in Barranquilla Parish, and his big message, the only thing I really remember that he said, was you could solve almost all the world's problems by paying attention. And I thought that was really powerful because it just sort of ripples across the whole teaching practice. If you pay attention to your students, they're so much more likely to produce for you. And if you can get them to pay attention to like what they're doing, I mean, it just kind of goes everywhere.
Absolutely.
Well, in the afternoons, twice a week, Becky Rains, our music teacher in elementary, hosts a yoga class, and she has a pretty good turnout. We're going to go now to a discussion with teachers just after their yoga class, when they're in the state of mind of finishing yoga, talking about the benefits of practicing yoga in the cycle of teaching.
Well, for me, I feel like my day is so busy and I'm very, it's just like my mind is going, like I have 100 tasks to do. And so this is one of the only times of the day where I don't have to think about 100 tasks or a lot of kids. And I think it helps me put things back into perspective, because you can get kind of a warped perspective if you don't slow down and just let yourself think about what really matters and what's important and slow down a little bit. Yes, totally. Sometimes I come to class and I don't even want to come because I'm like, oh, I have like a million things to do and I have a headache and I have to do this and I just like feel like I can't relax. And then afterwards I'm like, what? Like that? Like relax, you have time. It doesn't need to be done now. It's not that big of a deal, you know. It definitely changes the way I feel. And walking home, I feel like a different person on the days that I do yoga as opposed to the days I don't.
Yeah, for me too. Sometimes like I have so many things to do. And I'm stressed, and I think, oh no, I should stay doing what I have to get done. And then I say, no, it's like a time for me to relax, to get away from everything. And it really helps me. Like, I walk out of here, and I'm, like, renewed, like, without the stress. So it really helps me, like, to maintain a balance. Not everything, work and things in my mind going, like Becky was saying, do this, do that, and one and another thing that you have to get ready, but... like, it's a stop and it's a time for me.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with what both of them said. But I feel like when you take the time and you give yourself permission to find calm and peace and unity within yourself. So, like, you come to the yoga mat and you breathe and you move together in unity, like, with lots of focus on the breath. You're able to be in a place where you're fully present for yourself. Then you leave this practice, you leave the mat, you go out into the world, and you're able to be more fully present with every person that you interact with. So like in my classroom, this is just a way of life for me now. I look at kids and I read them and I'm fully present with what's happening. Or I try my best. I mean, it's always a practice, right? It's never perfect. But also, for me, it allows me to function in a place where I'm responding to people and interactions and situations rather than reacting to people and places and interactions, if that makes sense. Yeah. There's a collective, like we have a crew of people that come here regularly and we may not know each other very well, but in this room, I see them and we're breathing and moving together. Like we're going through the practice together. And at the end, you see everyone's like, like everyone has this like awesome feeling together. And then when I see these people outside of class, I have a different connection with these people than I do other people on campus.
And
Now, for me, it's different too, because during the day, you don't have time for yourself. You're always thinking on the children, on what you have to do. And it's the only time of the day that you can, like, connect your mind and your body, like, feel your body actually, because you're moving and running. And then at the end of the day, your back hurts, your leg hurts, and you're like, oh my God, when? And this is the time that you can, like, rest, breathe, and, like, finally feel your body and get a time to relax.
Time for transformation too, spiritual, both spiritual and physical, because you work in the physical and in the spiritual part here, because you can meditate and you can have your time to for yourself and for a harmony between body and soul.
Basically, it is the time that you give to yourself to, it is the moment in which you center with yourself and you're able to find your inner needs, that your inner voice, and in that way respond better to whatever are the external needs of your community and of yourself.
Now, we'll climb up the stairs to the top of the school to find Felipe Marizalde in his office for a discussion on how he came about being a psychologist at CNG and how he practices mindfulness with students and faculty.
I think mindfulness. Okay. So, yeah, I am a high school counselor, and I have been working in CNG for 5 years. So, basically, I work with students, especially, there are college counselors and emotional counselors, is how we call them. So our job is more from a psychological perspective. We have we support the students in an emotional from an emotional perspective. We don't do formal therapy. You know, if we have a conversation with a student and we notice that they need a little bit of going deeper in a topic, we can suggest a person outside therapy, basically. So that's part of what we do, but we also have other type of functions, especially, if, for example, at the beginning of each semester, we need to work their schedules and we need to support them in their academic process. So that is also part of our job, but the central topic is to support them emotionally, basically. So regarding mindfulness, I have been working with mindfulness in my personal life since I was in school. Actually, when I started doing it, it was not called mindfulness, or at least it was not popular, as the term was not really popular. But I was meditating. You know, I learned to meditate because I had a teacher in school, back in school, and he was very much into Buddhism. So he shared a lot of, he taught me some basics of Buddhism, and he gave me some books, so I started getting interested in the topic of meditation mainly, and I started to practice, you know. And so my practice has developed along the years, and probably 8 years ago I started to study mindfulness more in a formal way from the psychological perspective. And I don't know if you've heard from Jon Kabat-Zinn. He's one of the leaders in the Western world in terms of mindfulness. And I went to a workshop of him in the United States. And I also had a workshop with Jack Kornfield. So have you heard of him?
Yeah.
He's also very much into mindfulness. And and also I worked also with Thich Nhat Hanh, which is a Buddhist monk. He has a monastery in France. And he has been working with mindfulness for about 30 years in France. So he's also one of the main developers of mindfulness in the West, in the Western world. So basically, I think it's one of the most important things is to see the effect of mindfulness in your own life, you know? So when you practice mindfulness and you start noticing that it has a real effect, and that your life becomes much more functional, you become much more centered, And you start just feeling a general well-being in your daily life. Well, at least I started I do psychotherapy, you know, outside of, I work as a therapist, you know, I have a private practice. So probably 8 years ago, I started to include mindfulness with my patients, with my clients. And I started to notice the positive effect it had in the process of therapy, you know, and in the healing process as well. And when I entered TNG, I also started to, I work when I talk with students here, I try to share with them some mindfulness basics, and we do actually mindfulness with them here in this office. And they like it. And most of them have, I don't think mindfulness is necessarily for everybody, but I feel that most people can gain a lot of positive things about mindfulness. And so we have also done a couple of like workshops with students in the classes. I think it's incredible that you're working with little kids. At what age are they?
They're 8, 9.
Okay. I've never worked with kids that age.
But you're welcome to visit us.
Yeah.
Every day.
I want to check it out.
So I have a question just about the practice. And I haven't done a lot of meditation. The closest thing I would have to that would be playing musical instruments. And, for example, playing classical guitar. And I started noticing this kind of sinking that goes on in the body and in the mind. That if I play classical guitar, for example, for an hour straight, and then I go jogging, my coordination is exactly balanced, and I notice this incredible difference between running after guitar and running before guitar.
Uh-huh.
Or another effect I've seen is a heightened perception.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, I do African percussion, and Afro-Colombian percussion.
Uh-huh.
And then after playing, two different things I've noticed. One is if you play one rhythm and don't change, no improvisation, just play that one rhythm, it creates this kind of sense of heightened perception.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, you hear things that you wouldn't normally hear or notice otherwise. So for example, I was playing with a couple of Cuban guys and we played through about an hour of rhythm, and you start hearing like a bus like half a mile away and the creaking of the drum next to you, and like this really sad, but it's like a really nice euphoric kind of experience.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything comparable when you go through the mindsets and the methods of practicing mindfulness?
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little about like what is the practice, and then what are the perceptions? Like what do you feel differently?
Yeah, I think that's what you were mentioning is very interesting, because it's very similar to what I personally experience while meditating. I try to meditate every day, and the thing is that probably we are used to be thinking all the time. We're too much in our thought, and that means we are a little bit very disconnected to the actual moment and the present moment, and probably we lose that sensitivity to perceive more deeply and intensely, you know. So meditation gives you that possibility. I can connect it also with probably when you were a child, when we were kids, we were much more perceptive. And probably what you're describing when you play music, it's similar to what a kid usually feels in daily life, because they're not so much into their thoughts. You know, they're not thinking so much. They're not too much in the past and too much in the future, but more in the present. So when we practice meditation, it's because the practice itself is it's probably very simple, you know. The technique, if we can call it that way, is very basic, but that doesn't mean it's easy. It's not really very easy to do, because we're not used to it, you know. We have become probably very complicated in our minds. So when we start practicing, and it takes a little bit of time to develop this practice, we become much more simple in a way, And that's in the thought process, I mean. And probably that is what makes us like develop other, probably other senses in a more refined way, you know. So this is why meditation is a treasure, you know, at least for me.
So in the case of like child development, you know, Natalia mm-hmm. works with third graders, and I've taught third and second for years as well. And one thing I really noticed is the sort of measuring of importance. It's almost like a reading comprehension strategy. Like mm-hmm. one of the things you try to teach the children is like, what is more important? Like, what is the fact you're going to take out of this text, or what is the most important character trait?
Yeah.
And so weighing that kind of level of importance, is this kind of what you're talking about? Like, you know, a first grader will just talk and think, and mm-hmm. you know, the thought becomes speech. Mm-hmm. Almost as an automatic process.
Exactly.
And then as they come more of a second, I mean, it's very basic kind of levels I'm talking about, at second grade, they begin to filter and see, like, their voice through other people's ears.
Uh-huh.
And they understand that there's, like, I guess, another listener there, and they become more perceptive of the other.
Uh-huh.
And then as they get into fourth and fifth grade, they get much more group-oriented. At least this is a very basic structure, I think
uh-huh.
you see.
Uh-huh.
So in that young age, when they're so sort of stream of consciousness,
uh-huh.
How do you see this as like an important way to get them to kind of consolidate their thinking, or
mm-hmm.
to notice this idea of things that are more important than other things?
Yeah, I think that, as I said just a moment ago, I haven't worked directly with mindfulness with little kids. But I can see, I have, for example, a little cousin and a niece, and she is, in a way, very hyper, you know? So she's 8 years old. So, and I have worked with mindfulness with her. I have practiced mindfulness with her. And it's very interesting because I think that they just making a pause for them, because they have so much energy, you know? And sometimes the energy can be like all over the place, you know? So when they learn to have a pause, to just pause for a moment and to make basic exercises like, okay, listen to that sound, pay attention to what's to your surroundings, and make a list of what you heard. For example, okay, they start listening, paying attention to the plane that just went by, and to a little animal, or another boy running, or whatever. They start just like focusing and centering as well. It happens as a very similar process than with us, right?
Mm.
And that can be that you can notice a change in their attitude and their probably their energy, that they're more balanced and they're more focused. And I can imagine that in a classroom, that would be you could probably notice the energy of the class if you have a group of kids. Probably if you have them before, they're more like hyper, they're moving, they're doing a lot of things at the same time, playing. But suddenly when you just make the purpose of stopping and having this pause, you can notice that kids center themselves and focus easily in the topic. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen that.
Yes, absolutely. And not only that, but I also feel like that they can start whatever it is that we're beginning with a different attitude.
Right.
It's not only their ability to accomplish something, but
of course.
Attitude towards it changes in a
Absolutely.
Meaningful way.
Yeah.
And like you were saying, it's practice. So I always tell them, like, it's going to be hard. It's still hard. Yes, your posture is not easy. We practice sitting meditation, which is a Zen
right.
practice. So it's hard. It
uh-huh.
requires a lot of core strength. And so, especially for the boys, it's very, very hard to practice sitting meditation.
Uh-huh.
But some of them are, like, amazing at it by now because they practice. And they can tell the other boys, like, it was very difficult for me at the beginning, but right now I've gained so much from it. And my day starts very different because of what we do. And they value it.
Uh-huh.
So, just like you were saying, I mean, just being able for them to notice that this is actually something they can gain from.
Right.
Is important, not just doing it for the purpose of doing it, but
uh-huh.
actually being able to acknowledge what is positive
mm-hmm.
coming out of it
right.
in general.
So I want to introduce the concept that I've been reading about, and I was talking to Austin Levinson about this idea of looking deeply and thinking deeply into things. And we're talking about this difference between using
photographs and using film.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it relates in that film is so perceptually overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
It's happening very quickly. And it becomes, the way we treat the medium, becomes a very passive experience.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when you really look deeply into photograph, you have to contemplate things differently. It enables a kind of empathy for the subject that you might not get out of the film.
Mm-hmm.
You have to think a lot about the before, what led up to that moment in the photograph, or what happened just after that photograph.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are the kind of mindsets we're trying to put, you know, not just in the practice of a meditation, but in the deep thinking in the within the lessons, like how do you use these kind of mediums,
mm-hmm.
and get kids to look more deeply into them.
Uh-huh.
Do you have any crossover into the academic world like that? I mean, are you strictly working with student emotions and where they are, or do you help teachers in their mindsets of planning things?
Of planning, like a class, you mean?
Yeah.
Like working with them. I work mostly in the direct relationship of the teacher with the students. You know, I don't participate much in the content of the class, but I do participate a lot in when there's a teacher that is struggling with the relationship with the students, for example, you know, and to probably visit the class and to see how's the dynamic like happening, and probably working towards finding like some key situations, some key motivations and reasons why the dynamic is not working, right?
Mm-hmm.
So basically this is my participation with the teachers. But I've also connected to mindfulness and meditation. I've worked with some of the teachers that have been interested in this, in working with mindfulness, especially for them, you know? Because what sometimes happens with some teachers is that they start feeling like very stressed out and they lose a little bit of the control of the class. It's very challenging, very difficult. And so mindfulness for teachers is an incredible tool, because it creates, as Natalie was mentioning, it changes the attitude and it develops a lot of like the capacity of sustaining a class, you know,
mm-hmm.
and to having patience when the situation gets like out of control.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for teachers that would be a really incredible tool to be developed like more, you know, more openly in the school, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So basically that could be what I could think like in my work with teachers and the relationship with students.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said before, that kind of creates a well-being,
mm-hmm.
in the students and the teachers as well.
Right.
Have you had any like immediate results? Have any teachers come to you, tell you, hey, this is working, this is happening? What are some of the results that you have seen so far?
Well, yeah, actually a couple of years ago I worked closely, it was 3 years ago and 2 years ago, with two math teachers that were at that moment where they were new in the school. And they were having difficulty relating with this environment in CNG, first of all, and with a particular class. And it was very interesting because we started practicing a little bit of mindfulness before the class, or at the beginning of the class. And it was incredible, and the teacher was amazed at the results. One specific teacher was really, really amazed because he was struggling a lot, and the relationship with the students definitely changed, you know, because there's also something very, very special about sharing a mindfulness space, you know, a space where everybody's practicing mindfulness, sharing a moment of silence and of pausing.
Mm.
It deepens the relationship between the people participating as well.
You know, when I think about just the importance of sharing a perceptual difference in like how you interact with your students.
Uh-huh.
I notice that when I go see students perform in a different area, like maybe they have a specialist class they're especially good at, if it's a music or a dance or something very active or sport,
mm-hmm.
it really changes my perception of that kid.
Right.
You know, you're having difficulty working with a kid and then you see them really excelling at something else, or you see them in this totally different environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it changes the way you interact within the class as well.
Definitely.
Yeah.
definitely. It's really, really, really incredible. And something that I can add, and I worked also with this topic with this teacher, this math teacher, was the concept of acceptance, you know, in mindfulness. I don't know if you've thought about it, but it's central in mindfulness, like entering in an attitude of accepting that there is conflict, that there is tension, that probably some kids are experiencing that they don't like math in that case, and that they feel troubled when each time they come to the class, and just sitting and accepting the feelings and the emotions that are like coming up in that moment, it's a magical experience, you know, because we're very used to be like unconsciously resisting everything, you know, and that resistance generates a lot of tension. It's a very unconscious process, you know. We don't notice it very easily.
Like what you're saying, that we're constantly perceptually overwhelmed by intake.
Right.
You know, if you think about how many different ways we perceive.
Uh-huh.
And then I really like this idea, especially with the little ones, of focusing on one perception. You know,
yeah.
it's a very simple activity that we use, but we don't necessarily think about so much, but just getting kids to perceive a object or a subject. We used water, for example, and the kids
mm-hmm.
had to think about how they see water, where they see water,
mm-hmm.
where do they hear water, where do they taste water.
Right.
And it was really interesting having them walk through that process and identify
right.
all these different ways that they have this thing around.
Right. And did you notice like a change in their attitude and like probably...
I mean, I was thinking more content academically, so it was more like, oh,
yeah.
Now you guys identified the solid and liquid and the gas states of matter. I mean, so
uh-huh.
we use it more sort of like bridges into academics as well.
Uh-huh.
It was a great like immersion starting activity though, like instantly connected them with the topic. So
uh-huh.
if that's the change, I guess there was one then.
Yeah, definitely. That's very interesting, and that's probably a way of practicing mindfulness, you know, because mindfulness is not only like the formal practice of sitting down and meditating, but also like the general attitude in life. You know, it's a practice, a daily practice that you do all the time, when you work, when you share with people, when you play, you know.
Mm.
So what you're saying is super important. It's very interesting. And well. I forgot to mention that I'm also working with Dave Wendell in the Learning Center with a space for mindfulness Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Are you doing that for special education?
No, it's actually for mostly for staff,
mm-hmm.
and everybody's invited.
Great.
So actually you need to come if
yeah.
you can.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit difficult at that time because it's 6:45 Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 15 minutes before everybody starts, but I know that's like a difficult moment because everybody's running to get to class and everything.
Even better.
But that's why we chose to have it at that time, you know? It's an ideal moment to just stop for a little moment and pay attention and listen, you know? So it's been interesting, you know? There's some days that there's a lot of people, and there's sometimes it's only Dave and I, but you're very invited.
Great.
We'll
come.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
Cool.
Thanks
for
the invite.
Yeah, I think we'll stop. Ahora vamos a visitar una conferencia bien tempranito antes de colegio con el padre Adolfo Vera, Charlotte Samper y Sonia Bonilla sobre oración y mindfulness y aprendizaje.
Esto es Journeys in Podcasting. Entonces, viajes en podcasting. Y la tema hoy es, estamos investigando la importancia entre un ciclo de aprendizaje, la importancia de reflejar, entrenar la parte de calmar la mente o de pronto sacar la mente del self. Y estamos estudiando meditación, oración, cualquier cosa que hacemos en el colegio para dejar a los niños y los profesores reflejar y relajar.
Reflexionar. Sí.
Entonces, si puedes introducirse. ¿Quién es? ¿Qué haces en el colegio y cómo estás conectado a este tema?
Bueno, mi nombre es Sonia Bonilla, soy la profesora de religión de escuela elemental.
y estoy conectada en este tema desde el estudio y el aprendizaje de la religión católica y la participación con los niños durante este tiempo de clase. Se inicia fundamentalmente con sentidos de oración, momentos de oración.
Mi nombre es Adolfo Vera, yo soy capellán del colegio, sacerdote, vinculado con la comunidad educativa en el acompañamiento de los procesos de formación en la fe de las escuelas de elemental, media y alta.
Charlotte Samper, encargada de coordinar proyectos especiales y en este caso coordinar también el departamento de religión.
Yo soy Natalia León, soy profesora de grupo de tercero y practico meditación basada en el Zen en mi clase.
Yo soy Diego López, profesor de tecnología elemental. Gracias a todos por estar acá. Este es otro episodio de Journeys in Podcasting. Para comenzar me gustaría de pronto preguntar, no sé si Sonia o el padre nos quiera comentar, ¿por qué consideran que es importante hacer este tipo de prácticas en el colegio o en la educación como tal? Porque es importante conectar esa práctica de la meditación y de la quietud y desarrollar ese sentido de calma y de tranquilidad en un ambiente educativo.
Bueno, yo creo que para nosotros especialmente la oración es importante dentro del proceso educativo porque es abrir el campo de la experiencia de la fe. Se puede hablar de muchas realidades, se pueden dar a conocer muchas verdades de fe, pero el objetivo de nosotros como departamento de religión es que la fe no sea un conocimiento, sino una experiencia de vida.
Y en ese sentido, esa experiencia de vida que se despierta, digamos, en los niños, ¿qué impacto tiene en su forma de estar en el mundo? ¿Cómo, qué nos podrías contar sobre eso un poquito?
Bueno, indudablemente esa experiencia de fe transforma el corazón, y esa experiencia de fe lleva a la persona a la percepción de, va a usar un término un poco religioso, del trascendente, del otro. Entonces ese es el momento donde conectamos lo humano con lo divino, donde conectamos al lejano con el cercano. Entonces es lo que ellos de pronto nunca han visto, nunca han sentido, lo que para ellos de pronto es inconcebible, es poderlo hacer realidad en el ser, en cada una de las personas. E indudablemente para llevarlos a ser como ellos, a ser como él, ¿no? Porque la idea de todo ser humano es indudablemente permitir que Dios habite en su interior y que Dios transforme su corazón. Entonces es llevarlos a tener un estilo de vida iluminado indudablemente desde un divino, desde un otro, desde un trascendente.
Le agregaría al padre también la importancia como seres humanos de que no somos solo materia o sensación, de que también es importante en el niño el desarrollo de su sentido espiritual, y eso lo logran precisamente a través de ese trascendente. Son momentos también en que el niño, el desarrollo de la espiritualidad va ligado al conocimiento de sí mismo. Los momentos de oración generan en él un mirarse un poquito en su interior, en el silencio del mundo, en el silencio del salón de clase, mirarse un poquito y poder reconocerse a sí mismo y a través de sí mismo reconocer el otro. Entonces ahí se une el sentido del trascendente y también el crecer el niño en su sentido espiritual. A veces uno como docente se asusta un poquito de que el mundo está llenando a los niños especialmente de la materialidad, de lo material. Y entonces está dejando uno realmente y la sociedad está dejando de que el niño solamente se quede ahí y no se desarrolle como ser humano íntegro. Y está también el sentido de su espiritualidad. Entonces hay que propender mucho en estos espacios educativos, ya que se tienen en el caso de nuestro colegio, de permitir al niño ese desarrollo de su vida espiritual y trascendente.
Y en el siglo XXI nos ha pasado un fenómeno, y es que la vida se está moviendo y más rápidamente y la vida es más compleja. Y hablando de la espiritualidad, pues además de las necesidades del ser espiritual, están las necesidades del cerebro, y el cerebro necesita un momento para reflexionar, para un espacio para pensar, para analizar para dónde voy, qué es lo que estoy haciendo con mi vida, etc. Y como la vida se está moviendo más y más rápidamente, tenemos más y más responsabilidades, etc., pues no tenemos ese espacio, a menos que hayamos entendido la importancia de la parte espiritual nuestra, y a menos que nos demos un permiso de separar un momento y frenar y decir, Dios mío, te agradezco lo que tengo, o Dios mío, cometí una falla y necesito mejorar, entonces voy a hacer el esfuerzo de hacer el cambio. O sea, es una cosa no solamente espiritual, sino también física, el cerebro y la función del cerebro. Darse unos momentos para poder frenar la vida, que andamos al galope, frenar la vida y pensar, yo quién soy, cómo me relaciono con los que están alrededor mío, cómo estoy actuando como ser humano, estoy haciendo lo mejor que puedo hacer con mi vida, puedo mejorar en alguna forma, puedo cambiar o necesito cambiar ciertas cosas. Entonces, esa parte reflexiva de la vida es sumamente importante.
En ese sentido, Charlo, quería que nos hablaras quizás un poquito de cómo impacta esto la posibilidad de aprender de una forma más significativa o profunda al enseñar a nuestros estudiantes. Cómo tener de pronto estos espacios dentro del colegio o dentro del salón de clase permiten que el cerebro de nuestros estudiantes puedan asimilar mejor o comprender o sentirse más inspirados o más curiosos hacia algún tema en específico.
Pues definitivamente para aprender bien las cosas hay que conectarlo con una emoción. Y la espiritualidad o la oración o el espacio para poder uno pensar y pues analizar, digamos, la vida de uno o lo que va a aprender, pues definitivamente eso tiene algo que ver con las emociones. Entonces, al uno orar, hay una emoción muy linda que lo conecta a uno con ese ser que nosotros, en el cual estamos creyendo. Y en el salón de clase, si el profesor nos conecta con una parte de nuestra emotividad, lo que vamos a aprender, pues lo aprendemos mucho mejor. O sea, estamos en la misma, vamos por el mismo camino.
Eso es muy relativo a la discusión con Tim Burns hace 2 días, que habla mucho de eso, un ciclo de aprendizaje, un momento para cementar.
Sí, cementar.
La materia, el contenido, muy importante es tener la experiencia de dormir, pero también la experiencia para reflejar. Yo quería charlar o escuchar a ustedes charlando sobre las experiencias mentales. Y estamos hablando de 2 cosas, estados de mente y también estados de espíritu. En una experiencia de la iglesia, en un servicio, tenemos momentos cuando la mente tiene que estar enfocado, como
en el sermón, en la humildad.
También hay momentos para encapsular pensamiento, por ejemplo, en tiempos de oración. Hay tiempos para interactuar social, dando la paz. O cantando comunal. Y hay tiempos para, el objetivo es sacar la mente, sacar el espíritu de la persona. También dentro de la clase tenemos esas 4 estrategias también. Quería escuchar si en tu educación, entrenamiento como padre, la importancia de pasar personas por esas 4 experiencias. Y dentro de la clase tenemos lo mismo, lectura de profesor o de otro niño, momentos para el niño para encapsular sus pensamientos, mucho de la parte de aprendizaje social, interactuando con el contenido, y hay muchos que dicen que eso realmente es la parte de aprendizaje, que tiene que interactuar con otros. Y lo que faltamos nosotros, yo creo, es los momentos para reflejar y sacar la mente. Son realmente 2 preguntas.
Sí.
Estrategias sí. De la iglesia.
Yo especialmente quiero hablar de una experiencia de fe que de la Iglesia Católica viene del siglo XIII. Antiguamente se conocía como la lectio divina, pero hoy en día se habla de la lectura orante de la Biblia. Es una experiencia de fe, una experiencia de oración, que tiene un proceso epistemológico bastante significativo entre la conexión de la razón y el corazón. Y es un proceso que va especialmente en cinco pasos. Indudablemente nosotros tenemos el conocimiento de los cinco pasos, pero en la experiencia de fe a las personas se les va es induciendo en la experiencia del trascendente. ¿Qué les quiero decir? Un primer momento es el momento de la quietud, el momento del desconectarse del mundo, el momento de entrar dentro de sí mismo, el momento de empezar a experimentar el trascendente dentro de la quietud del ser, en el aire, en el ruido, en la lluvia, en el fuego, en los diferentes contextos en los que podamos estar metidos, ¿sí? Y ya después de que hay una quietud y nos desconectamos del mundo y entramos dentro de nosotros mismos, entonces viene un primer momento epistemológico donde uno hace una lectura de la Biblia, un texto bíblico cortico, pequeño, en donde empieza uno a hacer todo el proceso de la razón, de identificar qué sucede en el texto, ¿no? Personajes, situaciones, acontecimientos, milagros, actuaciones, ambiente, y es identificarlo para después introducirlo dentro de cada uno de nosotros como personas, que es la lectura del texto, tenemos que hacerla propia nosotros. Si en algún momento de la vida hemos sentido alguna experiencia de eso, o si en algún momento de la vida nos hemos visto reflejados dentro de ello, ¿sí? Entonces ese momento de la oración se llama, la primera se llama lectura, la segunda se llama meditación. Entonces es introducirnos dentro del texto y ser parte de él, como para unir lo que es la razón con el corazón. Y después de que ya nos metemos dentro de ello, hay una experiencia de fe de ese texto, ¿con qué me conecta con el trascendente? Ese momento de la oración. Pasamos de una meditación a una oración. Entonces, si ese texto me hace decirle a Dios gracias, o ese texto me hace hacer una petición, o si ese texto me hace pedir perdón, o si ese texto me hace sentir feliz, o si ese texto me hace sentir triste, o si ese texto me hace sentir con esperanza, es ya lo que yo tengo adentro, empezarlo a subir como hacia la dimensión del trascendente. Entonces está la primera, la lectura; el segundo punto es la meditación; el tercer punto es la oración, y ahí viene lo fundamental, que es que la experiencia de fe no se puede quedar en ese momento de lo que yo viví, sino tiene que perdurar en mi corazón con un último momento, que es la acción, el asumir el texto. Entonces, si yo di gracias a Dios, ¿por qué le di gracias a Dios? Y ese gracias a Dios, ¿a qué me compromete? ¿A seguirlo reconociendo en cada momento? O si le pedí perdón, ¿a qué me compromete? ¿Debo tener un cambio de vida? O si me sentía triste, ¿qué debo hacer para poderme sentir feliz? Se llama la lección divina. Y es el momento donde el intelecto se conecta con el corazón para que lo que tenemos en la cabecita, el saber, se convierta en ser. ¿Sí? Nosotros tenemos un objetivo dentro de toda la experiencia cristiana, y es que nosotros nos podemos quedar con muchas cosas, sino tenemos que vivir muchas cosas. Tenemos que ser personas que indudablemente tengamos que estar iluminados o transformados por la experiencia del trascendente. Que es ahí donde yo veo interesante el cerebro como un puente que comunica al humano con el divino. Porque lo que yo conocí, tengo que volverlo vida. Tengo que reflejarlo en mi ser. Tengo que reflejarlo en mi condición espiritual. Se llama la lección divina, que es la lectura orante de la palabra. Y es la conexión entre el saber y el ser.
Eso me encanta, porque nosotros en el salón, y específicamente en lectura y escritura, aplicando pues el Teachers College, hacemos algo muy parecido. Hay una lectura Pues yo veo la correlación y hacemos una lectura, el profesor hace un read aloud, una lectura al grupo, y los niños, pues yo siempre les pedimos que hagan algún tipo de conexión con el texto. Es algo que se refleja igualmente a su vida interna o algo de sus experiencias pasadas. Después pasamos a buscar un diálogo con ese texto, que es pues todo esto que estás diciendo, como ya de la oración como tal, que sale de mí hacia el texto también, no solamente qué me ha dicho el texto, sino poder interactuar con él de una forma diferente. Y pues finalmente, como el poder actuar, como el poder ver cómo esto cambia la forma en que yo pienso y cómo actúo y soy en el mundo, ¿no? Me parece una correlación muy bonita, porque pues veo que nos estamos apoyando de alguna forma entre todos para que los niños puedan tener ese diálogo interno que es tan importante, no solamente con el otro, sino también con algo tan simple como un texto, ¿no? O sea, como que puedan tener ese espacio.
Nosotros, perdón, sí. Voy a hacer aquí una escritura, y es, nosotros buscamos a que los niños sepan, ¿sí? Sepan, en español, sepan, sepan. No. Pero cuando yo le quito a eso la P, los niños no llegan a sepan, sino que los niños sean.
Yeah.
Es lo que buscamos nosotros, que más que un saber es un ser.
Sí. Bueno, entendí esa parte de coger una idea, una parte de texto y internalizarlo, y el último nivel es como actuar.
Sí.
Como, y realmente eso en la filosofía de hoy de educación está presente en muchos lados. Por ejemplo, John Dewey siempre hablaba de las experiencias espontáneas del niño, todo lo que lleva dentro de la clase, con todas las experiencias de la vida, lleva dentro de la clase, y también tenemos el currículo. Y el objetivo del profesor es conectar esas experiencias del niño al currículo. Si no, es algo abstracto, es algo... Entonces tratamos de conectar a sus experiencias real o cosas que ellos pueden actuar. Por ejemplo, en problem-based learning o project-based learning, tratamos de coger algo que el niño pueda actuar, algo que pueda hacer con su ambiente físico. Y mientras están estudiando el contenido, pero eso tiene un framework. Esa es la idea. Uh-huh. Y también entra la diferencia entre Piaget, por ejemplo, y Vygotsky. Piaget es mucho de los niveles de aprendizaje, uh-huh. que el niño tiene como madureces, que pasa por nivel a nivel, y cuando llega a ese nivel está listo para capturar este tipo de contenido, esos conceptos. Pero Vygotsky es casi al revés, dice que realmente esas experiencias sociales y nuestro ambiente, las acciones que hacemos en el mundo, que empujamos los trayectorias de aprendizaje. Entonces, dentro de todo eso es la parte espiritual. Y tratamos de conectar al niño, como Natalia estaba diciendo, que el niño lleva una parte espiritual también, que es casi prohibido hablar de esto dentro de la clase, pero siempre tratamos de conectar con esta parte emocional, que muchas veces esos gut feelings, strong feelings, reflex reactions, son conectados a la parte espiritual también. Y yo creo que estamos tratando de conectar a la misma cosa, pero cómo es, separamos esas ideas entre la vida mental y la vida espiritual.
La vida académica.
Y nuestro objetivo es dar esos momentos para que todos puedan capturar esa experiencia dentro de la clase. Sí, es momentos de meditación, oración. Había un artículo en Wall Street Journal hace 2 días, 3 días, que mucha gente está criticando las prácticas de meditación dentro de la clase, porque dicen que es un budismo dentro uh-huh. de la clase. Uh-huh. Mientras yo pongo como, mira, si tienes momentos de silencio, en mente puede hacer cualquier cosa en ese momento. Y es eso que queremos, empujar a un niño. Bueno, termina todo eso, no tengo pregunta, pero quiero preguntar otra cosa. Y eso es sobre la parte de acciones dentro de la clase, la parte como una canto, canción, o cosas activo físico que los niños practican. ¿Dónde está esa importancia dentro de la experiencia espiritual? Por ejemplo, como he dicho, es una parte de servicios, siempre hay canción, siempre hay momentos para interactuar con la persona al lado. ¿Por qué eso es tan importante?
Pues yo voy a decir, según las investigaciones, y leí una hace 3 días, La música es sumamente importante para el cerebro y para el aprendizaje. Entonces, entre más uno une el aprendizaje con la música, más el cerebro más va a recordar lo que está aprendiendo. Además, la música une y forma comunidad. Entonces, si todos estamos cantando la misma canción con el mismo mensaje o la misma enseñanza, pues más nos vamos a sentir parte de un grupo social o del salón o de la iglesia o lo que sea. Entonces, la música es una cosa muy importante, no solamente para aprender conceptos, sino también para unir al ser humano y darle sentido de comunidad, que sabemos que es sumamente importante, pues somos seres sociales.
Exacto, a eso voy yo. Sí. Tenemos la necesidad como individuos, como seres humanos, no solo desarrollarnos en nosotros como como unicidad, como ser único, sino también nuestro sentido de pertenencia y de comunidad. Llega y permite que se puedan hacer en el aula de clase específicamente los trabajos de doble índole, ¿no? El niño trabajando independiente como individuo, sacando sus propias relaciones, conexiones, predicciones, lo que necesite, y el niño dentro de su grupo de clase como tal o dentro de su pequeño grupo de trabajo, ¿cierto? Sacando, pudiendo interactuar, porque es una necesidad enorme del ser humano, sí. Ser parte de una comunidad.
La música es básica, ¿no? Has dicho, desde que empezó el ser humano ha estado cantando y ha tenido música, así sea... con maracas o lo que sea,
con las palmas de las manos,
sí, las palmas de las manos, lo que sea, pero siempre ha tenido ese sentido de necesitarla conectarse y comunicarse por medio de la música, el movimiento, el baile, y todo eso son necesidades del cerebro y de nosotros como seres humanos.
Yo pienso que una experiencia interesante, por ejemplo, en las clases de religión, es la oración en voz alta. O sea, esos momentos de oración en voz alta donde el niño puede expresar ante Dios y ante su propia comunidad su agradecimiento, sus necesidades y su propia alabanza. Yo creo que, por ejemplo, esos momentos son muy interesantes para los niños y eso fortifica el hecho de que se tenga una misma creencia y de que también el niño siente una tranquilidad, ustedes no se imaginan, increíble en el momento en que él puede expresar un sufrimiento que tiene, ¿cierto? En relación con algo de que está pasando en su familia, o un sentido de agradecimiento, gracias porque hoy pude vivir, y lo está manifestando no solo como individuo, sino ante una comunidad que puede tener los mismos momentos de necesidad, de agradecimiento o alabanza. Entonces, ustedes no se imaginan el sentido de unión que esos momentos de oración en voz alta generan para los niños. Es una práctica muy propia y muy interesante.
Esa es la idea, diciendo que son los elementos conectores que entre una diversidad nos hace vivir en una unidad.
Qué bonito eso,
sí.
Qué bonito eso. Y pues ojalá todo esto que están diciendo nos ayude a crear mejores comunidades dentro de los salones de clase, así como dentro del mismo colegio y pues en general, ¿no? En nuestras vidas. Muchísimas gracias a todos por estar aquí hoy.
Mucho gusto.
Gracias. Muy valioso todos sus aportes. Y pues ojalá puedan volver pronto a la próxima sesión.
Now we're going to video conference with Tim Burns of Educare out of Santa Fe, New Mexico. We have all at one time had workshops with Tim Burns. I saw him at ASA in Buenos Aires for a 2-day workshop. And I believe Natalia worked with him at the Tricon. CNG is hosting the Chai Conference next October, so I'm not sure if our schedule has space, but we would love to see him here on the CNG campus next October if possible. Now, let's go to our video conference.
I'm an educator. My background was in public school education for a number of years, and then my interest in what I currently teach about, which is mostly the brain science, began in the 1980s when I was working with students who were involved in drugs. And as a result of that, the interest has simply continued and spun off in various directions. And for the last several years, I've been invited to numerous international school settings where I do presentations for students, staff, and parents on various aspects of the brain. And that also has coincided with a long-standing interest in mindfulness, which originally began during my years of training in martial arts. And it turns out now that the brain science has caught up with the mindfulness practice, we had this new sort of wave of interest in how that might apply across the board in a variety of settings. So it's all about very exciting.
Cool. I went through a two-day workshop with you in Buenos Aires when they had the ASA down there.
Right.
One other thing, and then we had the fifth graders interview you that same year. And I remember you saying some really interesting things, and there's two things I'd like you to touch on if possible. One was the importance of having this meditative process somewhere within the 24-hour cycle to cement learning. That was one. And the second one was even further out. It was all having to do with how this relates to evolution in animals. You gave an incredible talk to the fifth graders about that. I don't know if you remember some of the topics, but those would be two things I'd be very interested in hearing about today.
The first one, refresh me on the evolutionary piece.
You went into about how music, rhythm, whale song were all part of our sort of genetic makeup and our social being. I don't know if you remember these topics, but I find it very interesting to be talking to the fifth graders about the importance of understanding our kind of connection to that evolutionary step.
Oh, very interesting. That seems a little vague to me. You sure I was the one to cover that?
we'll patch in those clips. Let's stick to the first part, just about mindfulness within the learning cycle.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that training in mindfulness is basically training those aspects of the brain that have to do with attention and the ability to focus attention. If I get a little bit too deep here, just interrupt. But if we take the three attentional systems, the first to arise and begin the process of learning is the alerting system. So our attention is drawn to something, usually in the external environment. And these various regions of the brain come online to alert the central nervous system. And that sets motion the set that which are the orienting elements within the central nervous system. So there's an alert, there's an orientation to whatever the stimulus is, and then the final step is the executive or planning for action. As it turns out, a lot of the problems with focus have to do with alterations, maybe even breakdown in that progression of events, or blockages, or what have you, which prevent the proper amount of this creating a plan, following through with the plan, and so forth. It turns out in meditative states, all three of these systems are finding a way to mesh with each other by the mere practice of focusing quietly on various stimuli or various states of being, breathing, the movement of the chest, and so forth. So, coupled with a quieting response, this ability to focus begins to change the neural structure. And that's what the science, to me, gets really interesting in terms of what structure of the brain actually improve in the process.
That's great. I was just wondering, I mean, last year in Costa Rica, I was amazed by all this brain research behind practicing mindfulness in the classroom and how it actually does change if you practice on a daily basis. Maybe can you talk a little bit about how it changes in specific patterns that maybe can help us as teachers that we can work on? Like, what activities could we do after practicing meditation that can enhance these changes in the classroom?
Well, I think just the most straightforward response is giving students an opportunity to actually do the practice. You know, explain to them what it is, how it's done, what the possible benefits are, and then have them do that routinely. Turns out that it doesn't take them very long to recognize the benefits, but it's a very innate response. You know, beginning perhaps with following the breath, maybe start with a chime or a bell to bring focused attention to the breath, watching thoughts come and go, arising and passing. Yeah, just doing it for a very few minutes and do it a couple times a day. And it doesn't take very long for students to recognize that they're getting that benefit. Simply because of the fact that most of our lives we don't actually take the time to focus inwardly. And it's that inward gesture that begins all these marvelous changes, rebalancing the autonomic nervous system, facilitating new connections in the brain, increasing gray matter, particularly in the frontal lobes of the brain, where the executive functions start to malfunction, especially in children with attentional problems. Is that
clear? Yes, absolutely. I was just wondering, since I practice meditation in my classroom every morning, and we do it for 10 minutes, and I do see a big change in how the kids walk into the classroom and how they respond after meditation. However, I was wondering, is there something else that we can do after meditation that will help them keep in this state of mind or maintain this state of mind? Since I teach third grade, my kids tend to come and go with their attention span. It's very short. We know it's very short, and that's something that our generation, new generations have. So I was just wondering what type of practices we could also add to meditation that will help them keep this or maintain for a longer period of time this special type of attention.
Well, that's a great question. Have you tried using a chime or something periodically, just sounding the chime and have that be an invitation to the students to simply stop whatever they're doing, close their eyes, go inside? You know, it can be as short a period of time as 10 to 15 seconds, maybe no longer than certainly a minute, and use that as a reinforcement. Because of the fact that with practice, these changes that happen in the central nervous system are easily triggered by brief reminders throughout the day. Another one would be to incorporate some quiet movement, such as Qigong. And there's a whole host of movements. I think I'm sure I did some of those, Chris, in a two-day program. Which are really meant to reinforce that mindfulness state.
That's great.
You walked us through several different intelligent play activities. Would you also recommend these as, you know, warm-ups or breaks to the day? I find them incredibly community-building and just sort of building this awareness of everyone else in the room. One of them was passing one ball in a circle while another ball is popping over their heads from person to person. And there were several others. Are these things that you would use as sort of like daily warm-ups just to get the kids synced in together?
Yeah, I think there's lots of ways of using them. The key to those playful activities is, especially in children, to give them an opportunity to achieve their own default settings. Chris, you might remember me going through the various brain waves.
Mm, yeah.
And in small children, roughly from about 6 to puberty, the default setting in terms of brain waves is an alpha state, which is that calm, alert, focused, but relaxed state, which really facilitates learning. So whether it's a brief meditative break, some qigong, some playfulness, some other form of movement, it allows children's brains to reset in an alpha state, which is associated with very enhanced learning.
That's great. Mm. I think that these are all fantastic tools. I was wondering if maybe we could give a little bit of feedback to people who haven't had the chance to hear about the changes that happen in inside the body per se, so that they can be more enticed to practice this inside their classes.
Yeah, I remember one thing you talked about, and it seemed really clear to me at the time, and now I can't really recall it exactly, but it was like talking about the 24-hour cycle that the brain goes through and the importance of how learning has times that it actually cements, sleep being one of those factors, and you know the importance of having these calming moments to cycle through all of the processing that went on during the day.
Right. Well, that was a piece on chronobiology, and you may recall going through the steps from bringing focused attention via the attentional system, that's followed by a period of downtime. And usually that's age dependent or age contingent. The younger children are, the more frequently they're going to need to go from that focused, attentive state into a state of relaxed downtime. So the downtime enables or facilitates the brain's ability to form those new connections. So anytime new learning takes place, the brain is very busy turning off and on genes that enable the protein structures to get created that form those new connections, those new synapses. So there's actually a physical material change that happens with new learning. What's necessary is to go through periodic downtime breaks following that wave-like pattern of Alcidian rhythm, those 90-minute, 120-minute rhythms, which are foreshortened in children. So that's the rhythm of the day, focused to downtime, playful activities, meditation, group work, what have you, and then a focused attention on something new. And then comes the sleep, of which there are 3 to 5 stages, depending what researcher we're looking at. And at each stage of sleep, a different form of learning gets consolidated. And then 24 hours after the lesson, roughly speaking, some kind of review, and that further consolidates the learning, followed by yet another review about 7 days later of the same material.
I wonder.
And then, pretty much follows in science, the earlier science, going back to the 80s as well.
I wonder if you could connect that at all to sort of the importance of individual encapsulation of learning, and also the importance of using the community and interacting socially with others to activate that learning. How does that relate to all this brain study?
I'm not sure what the interface would be in terms of how that would necessarily change the consolidation of, say, neural structures in the brain. But what we do know is that because we're humans, we're social animals, that most learning takes place in social setting. Hmm. And when we, as humans, have an opportunity to learn together, collaborate, corroborate, and so forth, learning is greatly enhanced. So it serves a myriad of purposes that support the consolidation of learning.
And then how would you fit that into what I would call, I guess this goes back to more John Dewey and Child in the Curriculum, where you have a child's spontaneous experiences in life and then they're kind of scientifically prompted experiences at school. How the brain changes between what is learned spontaneously and then how the child reacts upon a more adult, scientifically prompted learning.
I think it's an interesting question, because if we're not careful in a regulated situation such as a school, it can actually violate some of the principles by which the brain operates. You know, the brain specializes in picking out patterns out of chaos, for example. And children are prompted by their own internal motivations and musings about what's of interest to them. So, with all the best of intentions, sometimes the curriculum, which is prescribed, can stand in the way of that kind of relaxed, we'll call it alpha state learning, where it becomes very, very easy because we're following our own prompts and our own dictates. So again, by providing those opportunities in the classroom with prompts to go back to those default settings, it simply allows children to focus more readily on the things that we're requiring them to do. Hmm.
That's great. We have some questions regarding Qigong. Some of the people in the room right now are not very familiar with those practices, so they were just asking me what, if maybe you could talk a little bit about what this was.
Oh, sure. Qigong is one of those ancient oriental practices that's been around for, it's hard to say how many millennia, actually. And it has to do with the movement of energy, qi or qi, along the various, actually well-founded scientifically, energy gradients of the body and energy nexuses of the body. The theory is, this one theory is that when the life force gets stuck in any one area of the body, it causes health problems. Or if it's flowing too wildly in the body, it creates others. So the key seems to be to keep the energy moving very easily throughout these channels of the body, and of course including the nervous system as well that it ties into. So by doing these slow integrative movements, which also of necessity have a mindful component to it, it brings the autonomic nervous system very quickly into balance. And it turns out that if we want to find an access point or a leverage point in the body that most easily facilitates changes in brain states and changes in well-being, it's via the autonomic nervous system. So breathing, movement, mindful awareness all come into the organism by the autonomic nervous system. So if you can imagine those kind of slow, mindful movements focusing on breath, it combines all the aspects of it. And with practice, 20 minutes a day for 30 days is usually the benchmark that scientists use. Actually major changes. After that, it becomes much, much easy to enter into those states without taking a full 20 minutes.
So that was kind of my next question, was sort of time allotted to these activities. You know, I think about music and what Eric Jensen tells us about what a proper amount of music to put into the classroom is, and somewhere between 20 and 50% seems to be a nice balance of when to use music as calming activities. How much is too much? Or, I mean, what would you recommend as far as in a cycle of a school day, how much would you put in?
Well, if you look at the 90-minute Ultranian cycles, which is pretty much what we're trained to, And again, they're flexible. They can be 120 minutes. They can even be 3 hours, depending on what the demands are on our time and energy and focus. But a normal rhythm, an hour and a half, requires a period in there of what Lossi refers to as the Altrakian healing response. And by healing response, I think what he's referring to is giving the autonomic nervous system a chance to rebalance itself so that the health providing and learning enhancement neurobiochemical changes in the body can be enhanced. That whole model would suggest about every 90 minutes having a sufficient amount of downtime to allow the body to go back to normal. But again, the contingent factor, I think, is how much prior training has gone into it. If a person's had that 30 days of regular daily practice to establish the new neural pathways, it makes it much easier to enter into those brain-body states.
Well, I was also wondering, how does this all connect to creativity and problem solving? As you well know, this is what we're pushing towards too, and we really want to create projects inside our school, and we really want our kids to be creative and not just curious, but also find new ways to solve problems. So I was wondering, how does this, having these cycles of downtime and focused attention, help the students be more creative inside the classroom?
I think there's a number of ways to parse that. One of them is that downtime has been shown to effectively enhance the brain's ability to make those new associations and new pictures. That's really the functional meaning of downtime, is to allow that the external sensory inputs that come in any new learning situation to become quieted, and through that inner gesture returning to more of an inner response, it allows the brain to switch modalities into what's now being referred to, interestingly enough, as the default setting. That the brain's default setting is this quiet, downtime state. What happens during that state is the brain works now to create new connections in the association cortex of the brain. Moreover, because the brain is creating patterns of neural development in the frontal lobe of the brain, it's allowing more creative ideation to take place. And then another factor has to do with the cross-lateral exchange of information from right to hemisphere. It's pretty clear that people who are more creative are able to more easily move energy from one side of the brain to the other. And that's clearly implicated in mindful states, especially mindful states that include movement of both sides of the body. You know, that very simply, in my mind, explains why taking a walk, playing a musical instrument for a little while, all those things that involve rhythm and quieting and internal sort of reflection set the stage for the impending new ideas, new creativity. And by the way, I think last month's issue of Scientific American featured on the cover, you can find it online really quickly, and people about meditation and how it changes the brain. That's not to be missed. It's a great article by some of the leading researchers here in the U.S. And they do talk about creativity in the article as well.
That's great.
Would you mind commenting on what I would call ecstatic experience? And what I mean is sort of the removal of yourself from the self. So for example, percussion, drumming, some musical experience, dance, especially communal dance, where the person leaves themselves and feels like they're a part of something larger. How does this relate to brain activity?
Very interesting. Short answer is I'm not really sure. But it definitely relates to brain activity. You know, it probably has something to do with the super high frequency gamma brainwaves, which have shown to be pretty much associated with meditative states. My guess is that when some kind of trance abduction is taking place, in the way that you mentioned, trance dance, drumming, and so forth, my best guess is it has something to do with the interaction between these high-speed brain waves that bind consciousness and sort of push it in a new direction, and the much slower brain wave states, theta states, which are clearly active during the trance state. And it's got something to do with extinguishing our normal sense of self, as you're talking about it. I mean, those normally useful social constructed selves get a chance to relax, and we are able to go beyond self. That's got to come pretty close to your state of ecstasy.
Hmm. Well, no, I mentioned that because I see... I'm sorry, I didn't catch that last part.
It's an educated guess.
Oh. No, I say according to like dance therapy, drumming therapy, you know, you've seen these kind of studies where when people engage in these activities, I have an aunt, for example, who's 74 years old and dances all the time with other 74-year-olds, and they feel absolutely no pain. They, you know, a sense of happiness enters them. So I guess it's a kind of more of a minor trance state that they're going into.
Yeah, nice.
Well, I wanted to go back a little bit on what you were talking about, the downtime. And I was wondering, because I feel that it might be misunderstood most of the time, especially in the lower grades, as having downtime become playtime. And I was wondering if you would suggest that instead of having playtime, like free playtime with the kids, should they be instead doing some mindful awareness practice rather than just random playing or free play?
You know, I'm a real advocate for both. I mean, there are myriad benefits from children having open-ended play, and it's probably the biggest factor that's missing in the lives of children today. So much of their playtime is heavily structured, time-limited, created in advance with certain expectations from adults and so forth, all of which is fine insofar as it goes. But that's one form downtime away from tasks that we're requiring that children conform to. So I would say both and all of it have their place.
Let me end on kind of a just spurious question that came to me. It was more about literature and nonfiction reading. Is there any study that you know of where they actually measure where the brain goes when they go into more of a fantasy-type read as opposed to reading more didactically for nonfiction reasons?
Well, you know, I think it's hard to track what's happening during states of imagination within the brain. What I do know is that the education of the imagination, which starts very early, as soon as children begin to have access to language, since language is the vehicle by which images are transferred in the brain and expressed, that ability to manipulate images within the brain is the foundation and predecessor for all higher cognitive activities of human beings. Hmm. So it's a combination of midbrain functions, kind of functions which are coming online for very young children, with high brain activities facilitating connections between the midbrain and the high brain, which will continue to mature and develop, hopefully in ways that will allow even more imaginable creative capacities. And I might say this is a cautionary tale. It's a little bit worrying that children at younger and younger ages are having the images screened into their brain through screen technologies. Mm-hmm. And there's reason to be concerned that constant bombardment of images from screens into the brain at a very young age are preventing the imaginal structures of the brain from creating its own images and its own narratives and its own storyline. Hmm. So it's a huge topic, and I know that many, many people have a growing concern that, and teachers seem to be concerned as well, because I think it's clear to many of them that children just seem to lack some imaginal capacity which they would otherwise expect to be there by a certain age.
Well, I mean, on a positive note, reflecting from that, we try to use iPads, for example, in very imaginative, creative ways. For example, giving the kids a 5-minute reflection time to go out and they have a fantasy narrative they're creating. Most recently, a 4th grade class had to fantasize they were turning into an insect. So as they studied their insects, then they had to go and create this verbal narrative of what they were perceiving differently as they were turning into their insect. So these created a video log that we would then reflect on. So I definitely hear you as far as the threat to this bombardment of the screen actually taking away the parameters of our own imagination. But we try to counteract that by using it in more creative ways, where the kids are actually creating their own media with it, as opposed to having the media streamed into them.
Absolutely.
And then I think that's great. I'm very happy to hear that.
And the narratives as well. I mean, I know there's a lot of research out there that, in a way, it combats the fact that teachers are using it and parents are using media or technology more and more often and at younger ages all the time. But still, we do pride ourselves in trying to find ways so that the children can create their own narratives of whatever it is we're doing, rather than having, you know, it come from outside. So in that sense, I did want to piggyback on this whole thing that we were talking about technology. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about how having or being exposed to technology and such, like, for example, I use iPads every single day in my classroom. How does this exposure to technology would affect or change their ability to be mindful or aware inside the class at the same time?
You know, it has to do with, I guess there's a number of concerns that are surfacing and have been for quite a while. One of them has to do with how the brain processes brain technology. The way that the brain processes it requires me to shift into a state that it's not normally accustomed to. One of the arguments is that our brain has evolved to process information in terms of vision through reflected light sources, which surround us all the time. Except when we look at the screen, as I'm doing now, the information that I'm extracting from the screen is coming out of a radiant light source. So it changes the brain as it outfits the information. That in itself is a little bit freeing people, how it's required the brain to adapt this. The other argument has to do with the way information is presented, that it's so fast, that it's coming at such a pace that the brain has a really hard time extrapolating meaning from it, and especially in light of the lack of downtime, because the medium itself is so engaging as to almost throw the brain into a state of sort of compulsive, obsessive addiction, because it's using the dopamine in the brain, which is motivating reward chemical in the brain, and to be engaged, especially in the internet, is to keep pressing the trigger of the dopamine release that keeps the frontal lobe of the brain activated, but it's also a pleasure chemical, all of which is good, but it can lead to a kind of obsessive relationship to it. There's one other piece, and that has, that has to do with early childhood brain development.
Yeah.
When all the senses need to be involved, of which there are at least 12, according to occupational therapists, children are spending more and more of their time interacting with screen technologies, which only activate two senses. All the other senses can be said to be languishing in the face of that. So they're overactivating two senses, underactivating all the rest of the senses. And so the children are not getting that balance that they would need if more of their time is spent away from screen and in a natural, social, or cultural setting where all the senses would be properly engaged.
Mm.
So, you know, these concerns have been around for a while. I think teachers more than any other group are probably aware of both sides of it and admirably are attempting to strike a balance between all the pressures that exist right now to use these technologies appropriately.
Mm.
Personally, because of what I know, I would like to see the introduction come quite a place when they actually and see children more actively engaged with all their senses. Essentially, up till age six when the brain goes through a major benchmark change. But even later than that, I don't see what our hurry is.
No, and there is the case of the Silicon Valley Waldorf mm-hmm. School, where all the top Microsoft, a lot of the top administrative staff there, they send their kids to a school that doesn't allow screens of any type. So I can definitely see, you know, the creators of the actual technology.
Yeah.
We're going to have to close up because the kids are getting restless outside, but I'd like to close with one more question. On Friday, we're going to talk to the Catholic priest who comes to our campus here about mindfulness as well. And I was wondering if there are major differences between brain activity during meditation and brain activity during prayer.
You know, I think they're probably pretty similar. I'm not familiar with the research on how prayer changes the brain explicitly, but it would come as a big surprise to me if the differences were at all major.
Hmm.
I would have to think they're very similar. And of course, there's a long tradition, all sorts of contemplative, quiet, meditative retreats, mindfulness and prayer. Yeah.
Mm.
Thank you for joining us once more in Journeys in Podcasting. Our next one's going to be about iPads and literacy. So please drop by our Facebook page, and you can find me on Twitter at Ms. Nati Leon.
Or you can find me at Chris Davis CNG.
And I guess we'll see you guys around. Thank you for joining us.